by inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rains come tumbling down.
Welcome to this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. I'm Jean Thomas, and with me is Teresa Golden. We're both Master Gardener volunteers. We're happy that you've joined us today. The topic for this program is composting and vermicomposting. Joining us today is another one of our Master Gardener volunteers, Devin Russ. Welcome, Devin.
Hello.
Let's start by having you tell us a bit about your background and how you became interested in composting.
Well, I first had a vegetable garden with my father when I was a little girl. But at that time, we used to do things like burn autumn leaves, which I would never do now. After I moved to this area and had a garden, a vegetable garden on the mountaintop, I was, of course, doing some kind of composting. But I was also working in New York City, and I once signed up for a worm composting workshop with the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. And I just thought that was fascinating, and I came home with worm bins, which I've been keeping ever since.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. I like that. It's cool. So today, let's dig into the topic of composting. And let's start with the soil. Every gardener has a piece of the earth to begin with. The quality of the piece of the earth varies enormously. It might be too sandy or have too much clay. It may be depleted from previous gardening. We all know that an organic approach is healthier than a chemical one, and this is where compost becomes important. Gardens benefit from regular additions of organic material to improve soil structure and to provide slow-release nutrients. The reality, however, is that most gardeners don't have ideal soil. Fortunately, almost any soil can be improved with composting. So let's start with what exactly is composting.
Composting is basically taking any of the plant matter that came from your garden or your yard and letting it decompose. And the resulting organic matter is good for almost any kind of soil. I know you said there are different textures of soil. Some people have soil that's too sandy. If you add more organic material to a sandy soil, it helps the sand clump together, and the organic material is kind of spongy and holds water, which is one thing that sandy soil doesn't do well. Once you can keep the water from flowing through too quickly, you can hold more nutrients. On the other hand, if you have clay soil, which is what a lot of people in our area have, it's very sticky and the water tends to just sit on top and take a long time to percolate through. If you add more organic material, compost, or any other kind of organic material, it opens up air spaces in the clay soil that lets the water move through a little more easily and also adds some nutrients.
Well, I read an interesting definition of composting the other day. It's called speeding up and intensifying natural processes. So what we're doing is copying what nature has always done. So when you're walking in a forest, you find the gorgeous leaf duff there that's been going on for years and decades and centuries, and we're trying to crank up the pace of that for our own use in our own soil. So is compost just used as a fertilizer?
Compost will have some elements of fertilizer in it. If you buy, for instance, you buy a bag of composted cow manure at the local big box store, it will have the same three numbers that you would see on a bag of chemical fertilizer. They'll just all be very small. Maybe it'll be four parts nitrogen and one part potassium. But it does, you know, it does contribute some nutrients. The thing that compost does better than a more chemical fertilizer is that it's alive. And the big contribution that compost is making to your soil is all the many different kinds of living things that are in there. There's probably hundreds of different species of bacteria and fungi. There'll be little insects and bugs and worms and all the different creatures that help decompose organic material in the natural world will be added to your garden, and they're all beneficial.
So it's not just the fertilizer, it's the texture and the health of the soil.
The actual fertilizer component is kind of a minor aspect of the benefit of compost. The improvement in soil texture and the liveliness of the soil is much more important for the benefits from compost.
So it's clearly beneficial to the soil, but what are other reasons why Columbia and Greene County residents should compost?
Well, I always think there are two great reasons to compost. And one is, if you love your garden, it's going to improve your soil. But the other one, kind of on the negative side, is you're not adding to the pollution and to the incredible crisis we have in garbage management. Since, you know, things like kitchen scraps from your garden and, you know, grass clippings from your yard are all valuable additions to your garden when you put them in a compost heap. It's kind of a crime to put them in plastic bags and send them off to a dump where they get mixed with things like old batteries and chunks of plastic and things that can never biodegrade. And they'll add to the mountain of garbage somewhere. But, you know, because they're surrounded by little plastic bits when they're in a dump, they can't turn into good soil the way they can if you separate them out and keep them in a nice compost heap.
And I suspect it's a heck of a lot easier and cheaper than actually dragging even more garbage to the transfer station.
That's actually true. And that's a wonderful thing. I have no garbage collection where I live. I just drive to the dump once in a while, and I have to do it quite rarely because I'm pretty careful about separating out recyclables the way most of us do. But I also separate out all the food type waste. And when you don't have food waste going into your kitchen garbage pail, you just don't have to empty it very often. My kitchen garbage pail kind of consists entirely of little scraps of plastic that are too small to recycle. And, you know, I can just take my time going to the dump.
Okay, so if I decide I want to compost at home, what are the systems and mechanisms that are available for me to start?
Well, the first thing to remember is that Every bit of organic material from your garden will decay, and you wouldn't be able to prevent it from happening. So if you just drag your, you know, worn out tomato vines or your bag of grass clippings over and just dump them under a tree somewhere, that's a certain kind of composting, and that's fine. And it serves both of those purposes that we talked about. It keeps it from going to the landfill, and it'll improve the soil in that spot. Whatever tree you tucked your pile under is going to love having that pile there. But most people find they want to contain their pile because, you know, they care about how it looks, especially if your property is small and you have neighbors close by. You might want to keep your pile neat. You might want to prevent vermin or, you know, rats from getting at it. And in that case, you'll want some kind of bin. And a bin can be as simple as, you know, an old garbage pail or a ring of chicken wire to just contain your materials in one place. But if you don't want to even do that much, it's fine to just take your organic materials off and toss them on the ground somewhere. Critters from the ground will come in and find your compost heap from the bottom, and they will get to work decaying your organic material, and you'll produce some nice compost. It'll just take a while.
In a lot of box stores or garden magazines, you see these tumbling type composters. Is there an advantage of those?
The advantage there is that it all happens very fast. And I can't imagine why anybody would be in a hurry for its own sake for time, but I think that it's if you have a very small property. If you imagine yourself having a 1/4 acre lot with a nice vegetable garden in an urban setting, you're going to be producing a big pile of things like, you know, tomato vines and, you know, bean vines and stuff at this time of year, and you don't have a place to store them. So if you chop them up and put them in a tumbler, they're going to turn into nice high quality compost very quickly, and you'll be able to take the next batch along.
So you don't actually have to buy a composter. You can actually just build one, or, as you say, just find a spot.
You can build one. It's very easy. Something as simple as a ring of chicken wire makes a lovely container for most bulky stuff like fallen leaves and grass clippings. And you can also just dig a hole in the ground for things that you want to interact with less, like kitchen scraps. You know, just dig a hole in the ground, throw a pile of chicken scraps in, and scatter some dirt on top every once in a while. These are all beneficial.
I've seen pictures where you can actually build them out of old pallets as well.
Yeah, pallets are great. I built a compost bin out of bungee boards from an old bed. It was great because they're all tied together and a neat, you know, they're spaced out nicely. All sorts of scrap lumber makes a great compost bin.
Which is more recycling.
Yes, it's wonderful recycling.
I see Well, I used to read real magazines and not just online stuff. And there would be pages and pages of designs for compost bins and containers. And what's the deal with the multiple unit ones where there's like three sections?
The three section compost bin is very popular. I've seen a lot of them in demonstration gardens. And usually the idea is that you start collecting some stuff and it's kind of big and dry. Like imagine some prunings from your raspberry bushes and some you know, worn out tomato vines and stuff. And they're very long and bulky. You haven't done anything to chop them up. You just put them in one of those three bins and you're waiting until you've accumulated enough stuff. And then when your bin has piles of, you know, leaves and all those coarse vines and stuff, you move it into the second bin and you layer it carefully with some water to get it to start heating up. And that's the bin where it's working. And then after it's gotten nice and hot and it's done its thing for a few weeks and it's turned into crumbly black compost, you move that into the third bin, and that's basically just a storage space while you wait until you use your compost and carry it around and put it in different places in your garden.
So that's your harvest bin.
Yeah.
Okay, and you can take that out and apply.
But there's no particular reason why you need to have three parts. I mean, in my big compost bin that I have next to my vegetable garden, I have just one part, and stuff goes in at the top, and then every once in a while I harvest it. And there, I find there's lots of lovely crumbly black stuff at the bottom, usually a couple wheelbarrows full. And the process of harvesting it is when it gets turned, and then I wait until next year and do it all over again.
Okay, so you've discussed the space you have for putting a compost collection unit of whatever sort you're using. What about the necessary amount of materials to put into the compost? I live by myself, and my dog doesn't generate a lot either. We don't generate great quantities of compost raw materials. Mm-hmm. So how do you measure and evaluate how you would do that if you were one person as opposed to a household of five?
Well, I find that I just don't do any measuring. I feel like compost is what you do with the organic materials that are being produced in your property. Yeah. So I just put into my compost bin whatever is there. When it's October and the maple leaves are shedding their leaves, there's a lot of maple leaves. And in the spring, there's a lot of, you know, dandelions and stuff that I've yanked out of my vegetable garden. And all year round, there's a steady stream of little 2-quart containers from my kitchen full of eggshells and carrot peelings. And, you know, I don't pay any attention to an ideal ratio. But people have studied this and there are ideal ratios, but I feel like thinking about the ideal ratios are more appropriate for people who are making compost to sell to others, perhaps, or who have a big farm-sized operation. You're going to get some nice compost product no matter, you know, what arrangement of stuff you put in.
You're listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners from Columbia and Greene Counties. Today we're talking with Master Gardener Devin Russ, a volunteer from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. So let's dig in a little bit more. What is the actual chemistry involved with composting?
Well, it's interesting that you use the word chemistry. It's more biology than chemistry if you're thinking about what kind of high school class it would have been like, because there are so many living things. Of course, living things are all doing chemistry all the time, but the person who wants to make compost doesn't have to think about the chemistry. The chemistry is being done by the bacteria and the fungi and, you know, the grubs and the worms and the little creepy crawlies that are moving through there. They're stirring it up. And they're processing it, eating it sometimes. But basically, composting is it's a very slow-moving fire. What you're doing is essentially the same as if you burned your leaves. You know, you're gonna very much reduce the volume and release some of the oxygen into the air and some of the carbon dioxide into the air and get a much smaller product.
So one of the visual clues to a successful compost heap is that it shrinks?
Oh, yeah. It shrinks way down. It should get hot, and it should shrink, and it should shrink a lot. And you're very happy if you get a crumbly black product that smells like a forest, and that's called humus. And, you know, that's a lovely end product. But even if, you know, if you interrupt your process before it gets to the crumbly black stage, if you harvest some compost that still has, you know, recognizable, you know, rose prunings with a few thorns on them, that's fine to use too. Nobody's conducting a perfect compost operation out in the forest, and you know, the branches from trees just fall to the ground and eventually they become part of the soil, and it's fine if you put chunkier stuff out in your garden as well.
So the scientist would say that the making of compost requires carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and water.
Yes.
Okay, how, you don't have to get wildly scientific, but what's an example? Now you want, I know they talk about the brown and the green materials going in. Is that your carbon and your nitrogen?
Well, they all have carbon and nitrogen, but for instance, if you collect grass clippings in your lawnmower, the fresh green grass has much more nitrogen and a lower percentage of carbon than if you rake the leaves under your oak tree in the fall and you have a dry, brown, crumbly oak leaf. That's almost all carbon. So, you know, you have more nitrogen in the green stuff, including things from your kitchen scraps, whatever color they are. You know, if you cut off your carrot tops and some of it's orange, you know, that counts as a green too, because it's fresh and it has a lot of nitrogen in it.
I've got a lot of oak leaves on my property, yet it seems like when they start to decompose, they kind of form this mat or this layer. So in order to use them in compost, is there any preparation I need to do to use oak?
That's interesting. You do want to keep them moist. And oak leaves are famous for holding that like three-dimensional shape and being kind of stiff. So you could try and stomp them down a little bit or run them over with your lawnmower if you use a lawnmower. Some people might fill a garbage bin with dried leaves and stick a string trimmer in there to chop them up. Anything that chops them up creates more surface area. And since the living things that do the composting work on the surface area, you know, that makes it happen faster. If you really think your compost is stuck because it has so many oak leaves in it, I've heard that you can spray it with a little soapy water. And the soap is it's a surfactant. It kind of holds moisture against the surface of the leaf so that those leaves will stay moist longer.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like maple leaves have that problem at all.
No, maple leaves just squish down into a mat.
So now shredding the leaves works well. But now do you also make a sandwich kind of thing and alternate with some of the grass clippings so that each kind of spurs the other?
If you do want to have the perfect compost heap, there's a recipe that involves putting basically twice as many of the brown oak leaf type materials and, you know, one part of the green stuff, like the things from your kitchen and the grass clippings, and layering them like that and sprinkling it with water so that it has the texture of a wrung out sponge. And when it's moist like that, not drippy wet, but moist, and it has the layers of the high nitrogen stuff mixed in with the dry brown stuff, it should heat up and make a nice, if it's big enough, it should heat up and make a nice hot pile. You can't get a really hot pile unless it's at least 4 feet across. So if your pile isn't that big, it's never going to get super hot.
Now, speaking of hot piles, what's a hot pile?
Well, like I said, composting is a kind of slow moving. It's very like fire. It's a kind of combustion. So it's very slow moving. So it should generate heat. And if you do have a compost heap that's 4 feet or more in more or less in dimensions, it will actually get so hot that if you stick your arm into the middle, you'll feel it and you can see steam rising off it.
So you're aiming for hot because that's...
Well, you don't have to aim for hot. One benefit of hot, if you're a commercial operator and you've got, you know, earth moving equipment and you've got piles that are 20 feet in dimensions, you'll get a really hot pile. And one benefit of that is that things you don't want, like weed seeds and maybe disease organisms, will be killed. And that's nice to know if you're buying, you know, compost from a commercial operator. But it's kind of hard to arrange for it to happen all the time in a home garden. You might just never have enough stuff at one time to keep your pile that big. So if your pile doesn't get hot, I wouldn't worry about it because cold composting also produces good compost.
It's just slower. Okay.
If you think about what's happening to the maple leaves that fall under a maple tree in the forest, they never get hot. You never see steam rising from the duff layer under a tree, and yet they turn into lovely black hummus. So
does that mean you can actually compost year-round, even in the middle of the winter?
Oh, yeah. Your compost will be there all year-round. A Although it's, you know, and there are other tricks you can use in the winter. Like I have my worm bins that I keep going in the winter if you want to be a little more active in terms of adding stuff.
We're going to get into some intense worm discussions.
Okay.
Later. But I hang around with a whole lot of science geeks who like to do scientific things in their gardens and measure things. What's the story on activators? You see those for sale in the garden stores.
I do see them for sale, and I frankly don't know why anybody would buy them. I don't think it's necessary. If you're building a compost heap on soil, if you're not, you know, you're not on a concrete pad or something, the creatures that do the composting are going to come up out of the soil, and they're going to be coming down from the air, and they're going to find you. You don't need to go out and buy them.
What about if you're using a tumbler?
Again, if you're using a tumbler, you probably the materials that you're putting in the tumbler, if they're coming from a natural garden or coming from a yard or, you know, tree leaves that fell off your trees, they carry all sorts of bacteria and fungal spores with them, and you don't really need to add anything. Okay. I guess you could if you wanted to speed it up, or maybe if you wanted to compost something that was much more processed, like if you had, you know, a humongous stack of newspapers that you wanted to compost, you might want to add an activator because they probably don't have as much living things on them already. But if you're composting natural materials like grass clippings and leaves and scraps from your vegetable garden, I don't think you need an activator.
Do you need to prepare the newspaper like you need to basically mow or chop up the oak leaves? Or can you just put newspaper in?
Well, the more work you do, the faster it goes. So if you care about speed and you shred your newspaper, it'll decompose quickly. But the best thing I do with newspaper in my garden is just put whole sections of newspaper in places where I don't want weeds to grow, like around a newly planted tree, and then cover it with something that's a little better looking, like wood chips or store-bought mulch. And, you know, that newspaper, even though I didn't even open it up, I mean, that will also turn to compost. All the life in the soil will come up and find it and decay it, and it'll, in the meantime, it'll keep down leaves, and, you know, you never had to handle it to shred it.
So that's the slow-walking compost system.
That's slow compost, yeah.
I like that. Now, my scientist friends also like thermometers, and you see those in the stores, too. A soil thermometer or a compost thermometer, are they labeled for what the optimum temperature is that they're looking for?
Yeah, and I think sometimes the answer is about 160 is about, you know, a heat that you can get in a well-managed compost pile. But again, if you don't achieve that, it's fine in terms of you can produce lovely compost that never gets hot. It can operate entirely at cold temperatures. The reasons people care about temperature and sell things like compost thermometers is because if you get to a certain temperature, you can hope that it will have killed off weed seeds and certain disease-causing organisms. So if your compost never got hot and you had thrown in a whole bunch of dandelion seeds, they'll still be there.
So if you're growing vegetables, the temperature thing might be important because you want to knock out the pathogens and the weed seeds.
Yes.
So that might be something that you do want to gear for.
Yes. Although there is a workaround. What I think of, I never take the temperature of my compost heap. What I notice, though, is if I have something that is particularly full of weed seeds and I'm thinking about putting it in my compost heap, I might just create a different heap that's in a different place. So if the weed seeds came from a hot and sunny vegetable garden, I might take those weeds and go and dump them under a, you know, tree that has a dense canopy. And they'll compost there, but they won't cause any trouble because the dandelions aren't going to grow happily under that the oak tree with the dense canopy. And then again, if you have you know, if you're worried about a disease on your roses, you might take the rose leaves and go and dump them in the vegetable garden where they can't cause any trouble.
Plant psychology.
Yeah.
Okay. So how do I know when it's done?
If you get this lovely black crumbly stuff that's called hummus, that's the most done. And that's a wonderful product to have. And you can screen it and sift it. I do that. I screen some a little bit every year and use it when I'm starting seeds in the middle of winter. And that's a lovely product. But as I said before, if you have, you know, the black crumbly stuff will be mixed in with bigger chunks of things that haven't yet decayed all the way down. And if you're just going out and side dressing your, you know, the bean plants in your garden, or you're putting a little something at the bottom of a hole where you're planting a new tree, it doesn't really matter whether it's all black and crumbly or whether some of it is still big chunks. It's, you know, any organic material is going to be good for your soil.
So the beginning composter, should they expect it to be done in a year or 6 months or...
Well, it depends on how much you manage it. If you have one of those tumblers, for instance, you should be able to get the black crumbly humus out in a few weeks. If you have a big pile, you know, you might not harvest it, you know, for a few months. But once you get going and you keep whatever system you have going, you know, into a second or third season, then it's just more or less constant. There's always some stuff going in and there's always some stuff that's ready to come out.
Are there things that shouldn't be composted? So things you shouldn't put in your pile?
Sure. Well, first off, you can't put in anything that won't, that is not biodegradable. So nothing with plastics. And, you know, occasionally you're surprised to find a material that you thought looked like paper turned out to be paper coated with plastic. And it, you know, the plastic is still going to be there in your compost heap 2 years later. So that's the first thing. And of course, you don't want to put in anything that you might, that might make people sick. So for instance, if you have pet cats, you don't necessarily want to clean your kitty litter box by dumping it in your compost, however nice that might be for your garden. Although if you have a big enough property, I would say you could certainly dump the kitty litter box somewhere off in the back of beyond where you don't have to handle it much, because your plants will love all that stuff. You just want to keep it away from people. And again, you know, you might be in your kitchen, you might be saving your kitchen scraps, and along with kitchen scraps, you can save things like used paper towels. But, you know, if you've got somebody who's sick, you don't want to save things that they handled, you know, that would pass around diseases that can affect people.
What about meat? I hear a couple of different schools of thought. Like I have bears around my property and I never put any kind of meat or fat in the compost pile because I don't want to attract them.
Yeah.
But is that a rule of thumb or what do you suggest there?
Well, the usual description, you know, that's addressed at everybody is, you know, assuming a lot of people are living in more or less urban environments, says you never put meat or cheese or any animal products in your compost heap. But again, that's because it can attract rats or dogs or, you know, whatever big things. Again, if you have a larger property, you can take the meat. I mean, the meat is a wonderful addition to the soil. Just take it, you know, further off, you know, where you don't care if the bears find it or the rats find it. But if you are living on a small urban lot, you don't want to put in any meat or cheese or dairy products because of the potential for attracting animals.
So you mentioned eggshells. What about raw eggs? Can they actually go in the heap as well?
I guess that would fall under the category of animal products. If you had a whole bunch of eggs that were too old to eat, you know, you'd want to keep them off to the side somewhere because they will attract critters. Okay. And another reason to keep things like that, if you've built yourself a container for your compost or you purchased a thing, you definitely don't want to let the bears in there because they will shred your compost container to get at something like eggs.
Well, on this program, we've talked about invasive plants. And I'm just a little nervous if we, you know, perhaps there's some green material that you perhaps don't want in the compost pile.
You want to make sure, you know, if you're ever pulling up invasive plants, like for instance, I had a patch of English ivy that had been planted at my house, you know, decades ago, not by me. And now whenever I pull up the English ivy, I don't want to just put that in my compost heap because it's notoriously persistent. I don't want to throw it away either, though. What I do with my English ivy is I go and put it in the middle of a hot chunk of blacktop or maybe on my barbecue grill in the sun where it'll be really, really hot and out in the sun and dead. Once you know it's dead, you can put it in the compost heap. Another way to make sure you've killed invasive species is to gather them in a black plastic bag or a clear plastic bag and leave them in the sun. They'll get to be a very hot temperature and they'll be completely dead. And then you can put the dead stuff in your compost heap.
They call that solarizing, not
solarizing. Yeah.
We're talking with Master Gardener Devin Russ on Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. So once you've made this composting, how should you use it?
Well, it's wonderful to just add it to the top of the soil around whatever plants you want to be babying at the moment. if you're planting your vegetable garden in the spring and you scatter some compost in the hole when you're digging a hole for a tomato transplant, or you just scatter it along the row when your lettuces and carrots start to come up, that's wonderful. You don't need to dig it in. In fact, you know, one of the benefits of compost is that it's so alive. The soil that's already in your garden is also very alive, and the living things that are already in your garden will do the mixing for you. And, you know, sometimes digging extra holes or tilling a garden can do more harm than good. It's, you just lay it on top and it'll find its way to benefit your garden. Another lovely thing to do with compost is to use it to start seeds if you're doing that.
Do you, when you start seeds, I was curious about that, do you just use the pure compost? You've sifted it and you seed directly into that? You don't mix it with any other kind of soil?
I do both. It depends on how much you need. Sometimes I don't have a huge amount of compost at that time of year. So if I'm planting a seed of a plant that'll get big, like maybe I'm planting, you know, starting a pumpkin vine in a half gallon pot, I'll use some potting soil and some compost mixed in. But if you have tiny little cells that you're filling with, you know, just a few tablespoons full of material, you can start with all compost. It's wonderful for seed starting.
Okay, what about container plants? You've got houseplants.
Houseplants are interesting. You know, if your compost comes from outdoors, it's got critters in it. You might or might not want that in your living room. It depends on what, you know, you can look at it. You know, if you see lots of spiders crawling around, you might think, hey, you know, I don't want to add that to my big potted palm.
So for outdoor container plants, great.
Oh, it's wonderful, because outdoor plants do kind of suffer a little by being restricted to a container. So by giving them compost rather than, say, bag potting soil, you're giving them something that kind of reproduces a little more of the liveliness of natural soil.
And it's better for retaining moisture.
Yes.
Which we all know is an issue.
And it's wonderful.
Okay, great. Okay, what's next? We discussed the heat.
What are problems with compost piles? I've heard that some compost piles could smell bad.
Yeah, they can smell bad sometimes. Usually the bad smell comes from the living things that are anaerobic, which means they're not used to having so much oxygen, and they might take over your compost pile if it's been very sealed off from the air, especially by being wet. So, you know, if when you gathered your autumn leaves in the fall, it was a terribly rainy time, and you have maple leaves that are already matted down into that thick pile that they make, you know, where every leaf sticks together with water, and you put that on your compost heap, it's much more likely to get an unpleasant smell to it. Also, if you're, you know, things smell like what they are when they started. So if you are making, you know, a 5-gallon pot of onion soup and you have, you know, a big basket of onion tops to add to your compost heap, it's going to smell oniony for a while. You know, for that reason, it might be good to keep your big garden compost a little further away from where people sit and stuff like that.
So to alleviate smells from things going anaerobically, the easiest straightforward thing to do would be to turn the pile. Now, we haven't discussed the manual labor involved.
Yeah, and it's very hard work, which is, you know, because that stuff, the reason it's anaerobic is because it's wet, so it's very heavy. I tend to not get around to turning my compost pile until I'm harvesting it, and that seems to work out okay. I still get, you know, a lot of nice compost out of it. The best would be to, if you know that you have a lot of very wet material that you're about to add to the compost pile is if you could throw in a few things that give some texture that'll let some air go in there too. So that might be a good time, for instance, to throw in, you know, raspberry canes or, you know, some prunings or things that are coarser so that the air will circulate a little and then you won't have to turn it. It'll just dry out on its own.
But in general, other than the laissez-faire approach, the more often you turn that heap, the more quickly you're going to be generating the product.
Yep. Turning is all about making it happen faster.
And it also alleviates or prevents the anaerobic issues, which is what the neighbors tend to notice right away, no matter how far away they are.
Yeah, I find the problem with smelly compost is I don't think it's all that common. But I think the big issue with, going to the effort of turning a compost heap is just to make it happen fast. So if you're not concerned about fast, you can just pile your stuff off in a remote corner and let it wait for a year and it'll happen.
Another problem I hear about compost piles is that they never get hot enough. Now, you said that's unless you're worried about killing any seeds that are in the pile, you shouldn't worry too much about it. But if you do want to make it hotter, is there anything specific you need to do?
Yeah, you need to get it to be, it has to have dimensions that are at least 4 feet. It has to be a big pile, and you have to have enough nitrogen in there. So if you're, if you've built yourself a big, beautiful pile and you stick your hand in a week later and it's not getting hot, one thing you can do is to just, give it a handful of nitrogen fertilizer, and that'll rev it up.
In my nitrogen, you mean add more greens?
Yeah, add more greens, or just literally add a handful of chemical fertilizer. If you're keeping a big compost heap and you're worried about that heating up issue, you can just buy yourself some high nitrogen fertilizer, like lawn fertilizer, and add a little once in a while to make sure it heats up all at once.
Okay, that created a thought in my tiny little head. Milorganite would be a good choice to use for that. The milorganite is made from processed human waste and sewage. But that next step in the logic is that manure should be something that's usable for compost.
There are people who've studied different kinds of manures. You could probably go on the web and find charts that tell you the different nitrogen content of manure from different animals. Chickens are famous for having very high nitrogen. So if you have a friend who has some chicken droppings, you add that to your pile, it's going to heat up. Manure is a great addition to a compost pile.
But it needs to be aged?
Some do. Again, it depends on how fast you want to use your compost. Usually when you hear talk about aging manure piles, they're talking about aging it before you put it on your plants, not before you put it in your pile. So you could take fresh manure, put it in your compost pile. You don't want to put the fresh manure right in your garden because it can be a little too strong and burn a tender plant.
And then don't you have an issue of if you want to use it in vegetable gardens, you have to make sure the compost is also aged?
Composting kind of is an aging process. I don't think you have to, once your compost is you've reached that black, crumbly, humusy layer, it's ready to go. You don't have to store it before you use it.
So the key is to make sure it reaches that stage.
But again, even if you don't, if you take half-made compost and add that to your garden, your garden's going to love you for it. But what will happen is if you take half-made compost that still has recognizable bits of maple leaf or something in it, and you put that around your tomato plants, it'll just finish composting right there next to your tomato plants.
Now comes the juicy stuff.
Well, before we get to that, let me talk to our listeners and let them know that we're talking with Master Gardener Devin Russ on Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. So, Devin, earlier you mentioned that indoor composting was an option, so that you don't necessarily have to go outside to build your compost pile. And could you tell us more about this? I understand that's called vermicomposting.
Yes, vermicomposting means composting with worms. And there's a certain kind of worm. This isn't just any worm. The best composting worm is called Icenia fetida or red wrigglers. They're they're good for this because they naturally live in the duff layer at, on top of the soil in a forest. And you can take them, and they don't travel far in their natural environment. So if you put them in a plastic bin full of damp newspaper, they feel like they're at home. They're in the duff layer of a forest, and they will happily live in your plastic bins. I have had two bins full of worms going for at least 15 years. And
wow.
Yeah, and they're wonderful. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of like having little pets that need very, very little care. You can go and play with them when you want to and give them some nice things to eat. But if you go away and leave them for 3 months and never open their bin, when you come back, they will still be there. and they're fun to look at.
So why should someone consider using worms inside the house instead of outdoor composting? Is there advantages?
Well, one advantage is if you don't have access to the outdoors, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, I learned about worm composting from the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. So clearly they felt like a lot of their audience were people who lived in apartments and loved the idea of not just adding their banana peels and coffee grounds to the garbage stream, you know, because they wanted to be ecologically responsible. So if you have a bin under your kitchen sink, even in an apartment, even if you're up on the fifth floor, you can toss your banana peels and your coffee grounds in every morning. They'll feed the worms. And, you know, that stuff didn't go out and get carried around in a garbage truck and taken to a dump. And right. You do produce lovely material that you can add to your houseplants, or you can take a bag of it down to your, you know, your allotment garden or whatever.
And for those people who don't really want to go outside to get rid of their kitchen waste in a compost pile, yeah, in the middle of the winter.
That's me in the winter, yeah. I have a compost bin out next to my vegetable garden, but in the winter it's so much nicer to just carry, you know, the banana peels and the coffee grounds down to the basement and toss them in a bin.
So some worms are not good citizens in a bin.
Right. And often that's because it's not a happy place for a worm to be. So, for instance, the classic worms that most people around here think of are the big red guys, the night crawlers. They're the ones that can get to be like, 6 or 8 inches long. And, you know, they travel long distances. They can travel 30 feet or more. They can travel vertically in the soil as much as 10 feet. And, you know, those critters are just not happy in a bin. If you put them in a bin, the first thing they'll do is basically get out as soon as they can. So, you know, trying to compost with them is just not, it just doesn't work. Whereas with the red wrigglers, the Yersinia foetida, they don't want to get out. If you make a brand new worm bin, and one way to get the worms to settle down is to just leave the lid off so that it's exposed to the light, and then the worms have to dive underneath your shredded newspaper and your vegetable scraps in order to find a nice dark spot, and that's what they will do. They will not try and get out. They will dive down.
So that's worm psychology.
Yeah.
So we hear a lot in Columbia Green Counties about an invasive worm called the jumping worm. Is that an option to use?
Oh, gosh, no. Now they're horrible. They're taking over our area, and once you have jumping worms, you basically will not have any other kinds of worms living in the same environment because they're so good at reproducing and so energetic. I think a lot of people don't know that there are hundreds of different kinds of species of worm. Saying worm is like saying bird. So when you're doing worm composting, you're doing worm composting with this one particular bird. Think of it as, say, a bluebird. And the jumping worms are like, you know, an albatross. They're just something totally different, you know, if you focus in enough, and not at all related to to the worms that you use for composting.
So the red wrigglers are the way to go.
Yeah, red wrigglers are the way to go. Well, and if you're interested in starting a worm bin, you can buy them online.
Now talking
about...
They'll
come to you in the mail.
Oh, those little guys. Population control. When does your colony outgrow its bin?
Well, you know, when you have lots and lots of worms, you usually also have lots and lots of worm castings, which is the product of a worm bin. You know, it's just a fancy way of saying worm poop. The worms have processed all those kitchen scraps you put in their bin and the newspaper, and they've turned it into this black, crumbly stuff. Again, it's a kind of hummus. And if you're having a lot of worms, you also have a lot of that. So you just scoop some of it out and put it to use. Take it out to your garden.
So as you harvest it, you're controlling your population and just replacing it with, okay.
Even if you try and separate the worms from the worm poop, it's really, really hard to do. You inevitably end up with one pile that has lots of worms and a little bit of worm castings, and then another pile that has lots of worm castings and a few worms, and that's as good as it gets. And you just take the pile that has more worm castings than worms, put it in your garden. Those worms will die, but that's okay, because they will be replaced very quickly. They're very, very good at reproducing. Worms are hermaphroditic. That means every single worm reproduces, and they do it every 6 weeks. Every 6 weeks, they make a worm case, and each little worm case has 6 to 10 baby worms in it. And it's just, you can do the math, but worms have no trouble replacing themselves.
But they don't get overcrowded as long as you keep removing the...
No, by the time they've gotten overcrowded, it's time to harvest them and move it out. And, you know, frankly, you know, they're just worms, so you don't have to get too... You don't have to get too sympathetic with them. If they're overcrowded and some of them die of starvation there in their worm box, that's okay too. I guess what'll happen to their bodies? They'll be processed into your worm castings. Everything will go along. But as I say, you know, you can keep the bin going for years and years and years, and without ever having to replace worms.
So European earthworms are known to be good for the garden because they aerate the soil. With the prolific characteristics of the red wigglers, do you run into the issue of having too many, say, in a vegetable garden?
Well, they don't live through the winter around here, so they don't become a permanent part of your garden. Which is, okay. No, it's nice to know, because as I say, when you're trying to harvest your worm castings, you're inevitably going to take some live worms and you're going to go out and put them in your vegetable garden, but they won't be there next year.
Okay. And so if someone wants to get started with vermicomposting, and you obviously need a bin, how does that bin have to be prepared? You know, what size bin do you usually go with, and... Well, how do you get started?
You can buy worm bins. And as I say, there are places you can go online where you can buy worms and worm bins. But you can also make your own for next to no money. Any kind of plastic bin. They do need air. So if you have a plastic bin of some kind, maybe a 20 to 40 gallon bin that you might use for storing sweaters or Christmas decorations or whatever, you just buy them cheaply at a big box store. Just drill a few holes. So that the worms have access to some air, and then fill the bin with shredded newspaper that you have made damp. You know, maybe you've shredded it over your kitchen sink and sprayed it with some water, and then add some food scraps, some, you know, carrot peelings and, you know, brown lettuce and stuff like that, and then put in your worms, and away you go.
So I have to ask the idiot question. That's my job. You drill holes in the top, not the bottom.
Well, the worms would actually like it best if you drilled holes in the bottom, because they don't want to have too much water in there. But I find, since this is an indoor project, that I do not want holes in the bottom. So even though there are books out there that say you need holes in the bottom for drainage, I deal with drainage by just looking in there once in a while and making sure that there isn't too much liquid at the bottom. If there is a lot of liquid accumulating at the bottom, I add more dry newspaper, and the water will all move from the little puddles at the bottom into your dry newspaper once you've closed the lid for a while.
That sounds better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you put the holes high enough so that the worms can't crawl out.
Well, like I said, they don't want to crawl out. So it really doesn't matter. You don't have to think about the holes being too small for a worm or anything like that. They just don't crawl out. The one thing you do have to think about with composting, because it's an indoor project, you have to be a little more careful. I mean, when we were talking about outdoor composting, I was just like, oh yeah, you got anything, you can put it in there. You know, they say you don't want to put meat in, but maybe you just want to put your meat someplace else. Yeah, you do have to be careful about what you put in a worm bin, because it's in your house. So you don't want to bring any outdoor stuff into your worm bin. However much the worms would love to eat your maple leaves and your grass clippings, but you don't ever give them stuff from your garden. Because whatever you have in your garden, you know, the leaves from your tomato plants or whatever, is going to have insect eggs and stuff on it. You know, you're not even going to be aware of it until the next time you open your worm bin and things come out at you.
And how often has this happened?
So that's the big rule for worm bins, is that only indoor stuff goes in, stuff that went through your kitchen or shredded newspaper. You do sometimes, I've never had nasty critters in there. You do sometimes see something like a slug. But one thing that's pretty, the most common kind of pest people have in a worm bin is fruit flies. One thing that I put in my worm bin most often is bananas, because I eat one for breakfast every day. And tropical fruits, you know, will have fruit fly eggs on them. A lot of the fruit flies are tropical animals. They're laying their eggs on these fruits before they get to you. And because we only eat the inside of the banana, we tend not to wash bananas. So, you know, when you have a banana peel, you probably have fruit fly eggs. And there are ways to deal with this. One way would be to keep your banana, you know, put it in a freezer for a couple of days, maybe before you add it to work to your worm bin. And another way to deal with it is to, like, put it in a sheet of newspaper or a used lunch bag or something like that before you put it in your worm bin, so that if the fruit fly eggs do hatch, they just find themselves with a paper barrier that keeps them from flying out at your box. And, you know, fruit flies only live for one day, so that's enough to solve your problem.
So you have a little tiny zoo.
You have a little tiny zoo. It's surprisingly fun. I you get to watch them. I've taken my worm bins to lots of events at schools and stuff. The kids really get into, you know, giving them names, you know, watching them wiggle around.
So do you actually add any browns, or is the newspaper basically your fundamental brown layer and you mostly add greens?
Yeah, the newspaper takes the place of, you know, what leaves would do in an outdoor compost heap. But again, it's free of insect eggs.
And the other thing I would think people might worry about is the smell, especially because it's indoors. So I assume you don't put meat or grease or anything like that.
Yeah, you don't put meat in because of the smell. And also, you know, to your own taste, you might not want to put in certain smelly foods like onions, you know, because they'll smell like onions for a while. And there are a few foods that worms don't like. So for instance, if you put in orange peels, even though orange peels are, you know, a lovely addition to a compost heap in general, worms just will leave them alone. And, you know, 2 years later, that orange peel will still be there. So you learn not to put in some of those things. But I find the bins actually smell very nice. When I've taken my worm bins to show and tell at some schools, one thing I always ask the kids to do is to smell it and tell me what it smells like. And some kids don't want to hear the question. They want to answer it before they've tried smelling. And they say, oh, it's disgusting. It smells like garbage. But the kids who actually stick their heads in and smell and say, oh, it smells nice. It just smells like forest, because it's very like the process that forms soil. You know, you're doing that in a microcosm. So it smells like nice soil.
So you're rotting and recycling things that we're finished using.
That's right.
And turn it into a wonderful product.
Yeah, exactly.
How long does this process take?
Again, I guess from the very, if you were starting a brand new bin, you would first have worm compostings to harvest perhaps 6 months later. But once you've gotten going, you never think about it. You can just basically go in and harvest some stuff when you want to. And by the way, the worm castings are a wonderful product. Some people buy worm castings. It's amazing how pricey it is to buy worm castings.
Oh, they sell little bags of it in the market.
They sell little bags of it for $15 or $20, you know, because it's so good for plants. There's been some research done that not only do worm castings improve the texture of soil and also add a little bit of fertilizer, they also suppress certain plant diseases, which is kind of a wonderful thing to know.
So we've learned a ton about composting today. This is awesome. Before we close up, are there any health and safety guidance or guidelines that you would suggest for small-scale composters?
Just the things I mentioned before about keeping obvious sources of disease away from where you'll have to handle it much. The big example is always the cat litter box, and because people love their pets, so a lot of us are cleaning up after pets. And you know, clearly your plants are going to love that material. Plants are going to think pet droppings are a great addition to their soil, but you want to make sure you keep that away from where people will have to handle it.
And as I would suspect, especially with the vermicomposting, one of the key things is to make sure people wash their hands after they handle compost.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
To be on the safe side.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I think we've covered everything from worms to nuts. You can contact the extension and the master gardeners at the numbers we've been giving you. And there are many other sources, including get in with our list of classes, because you will be able to meet Devin in person from time to time when she has her worm classes and teaches you how to build your own bin. Spring Garden Day.
Yes.
We see her pretty frequently. So you could, Cornell Cooperative Extension is at ccecolumbiagreen.org, or you can email the Master Gardeners directly at colgremg@cornell.edu. The Master Gardener volunteers are available frequently, but we're also frequently busy, so be patient when you do call in, and we'll be happy to help you when you catch up to us.
So thank you for joining us today on Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. Stay tuned for the next episode.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreen.org, visit us in Hudson or in Accra, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below till the